Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Ann Ball and Alice Bryant. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, a Palestinian student who was at first denied entry to the United States has been admitted to the country. Ismail Ajawi planned to attend Harvard University in Massachusetts. Harvard's student paper reported that he arrived at the university on Monday in time for the start of classes Tuesday. A lawyer representing Ajawi's family released a statement to thank his supporters. The statement said, "We hope now that everyone can respect our and Ismail's privacy and he can now simply focus on settling into college and his important classwork." Last week, Ajawi told the Harvard Crimson newspaper that U.S. federal agents detained him for 8 hours at Boston's airport. He said they searched his electronic devices and questioned him about his friends' social media posts. They included political points of view that oppose the U.S., he said in a statement. Ajawi wrote, "I responded that I have no business with such posts and that I didn't like, share, or comment on them, and told her that I shouldn't be held responsible for what others post." A U.S. Customs and Border Protection official, however, would not confirm the information. The official told the Associated Press that the decision to cancel Ajawi's visa was based on information discovered during an inspection. The official added, he can still try to reapply for a visa to enter the country. Several Harvard student groups then organized a petition to support Ajawi's admission to the U.S. The United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees and the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education also called on the U.S. government to admit him. Ahmed East, a not-for-profit organization, awarded Ajawi a scholarship to attend Harvard. The group said the U.S. Embassy in Beirut examined his case and reissued his visa.
The United Nations Refugee Agency says that more than half of the world's 3.7 million refugee children do not go to school. The UNHCR said that means these children will not gain the skills they need to build a valuable future. The UNHCR found that as refugee children get older, fewer go to school. The report said that 63% of refugee children go to primary school. That is compared to 91% for children around the world. However, only 1 in 4 refugee teenagers gets a secondary education, compared to 84% of teenagers worldwide. The UN Refugee Agency said a lack of money is keeping the refugee children out of school. UNHCR spokesperson Melissa Fleming called the failure to invest in refugee education unwise. She said, "This is not only sad, but also foolish." Not investing in refugees, people who have fled war zones, people who have fled countries where the world is interested in the future of peace, is not investing, very simply, in the future of its people. The UNHCR supports a new program aimed at quickly starting up secondary education efforts for refugees. The program will seek to build and repair schools, train teachers, and provide financial support to help refugee families pay for the expenses of sending their children to school. Mamadou Dion Bald is UNHCR Deputy Director of the Department of Resilience and Solutions. He told VOA that some small secondary education projects for refugee teens will begin before the full programs get started. He said efforts will start in a resolute way in a number of countries in the Eastern Horn of Africa and in Asia. Then the program will extend to more countries. He said officials will take into consideration the limited amount of resources that are available for such a program. I'm Ann Ball.
If you live in a place where most people speak the language you are learning, you may use the language for several hours each day. So it may become part of your inner speech. In other words, you start thinking in that language. Your mind stops trying to translate things from your native language into the second language. But the majority of the VOA Learning English audience lives in places where English is not the main language. This may be true for you. You may not have many chances to practice English. You may even be self-taught. When you speak, your speech might be slower than you would like. This is because your mind is still translating from your first language, which can also sound unnatural. English, like every other language, has its own sentence structure. The good news is that thinking in English can bring you a huge step closer to fluency. It is not very difficult, but it does take conscious effort and practice. On today's education tips, we will share some mental exercises that can help. Most experts note that it's best to start small. So, a good first step is to think in individual words. Look around you. What do you see? In your head, try to name each object in your surroundings. Charles Thomas has taught English to union members, children, and teenagers for over 10 years. He has also helped open schools in several countries. He currently works for EF International Schools in Washington, D.C. Thomas tells his students to name the things that they see around them wherever they are.
As you continue with this, it becomes more of a habit. So things are going to pop up into your head. Computer, telephone, chair, desk, whatever it is, wherever you are.
Start with nouns and then add in verbs, he suggests. He says you can also do this at home when you wake up and before you go to sleep. Teacher Andrew Hinshaw also finds this exercise helpful. He has been teaching English for 12 years, including in Vietnam, for the U.S. Department of State. He currently teaches at the Carlos Rosario International Public Charter School in Washington, D.C. Hinshaw remembers one method some of his Vietnamese students liked.
I've had students tell me that they label everything in their room or their apartments so that these English words kind of stick in their heads.
Another exercise that both Thomas and Hinshaw suggest is describing in your mind objects you don't know the words for. An example would be if you couldn't think of the word garage, Thomas says.
If you're looking at your house and you see your garage, but you can't think of the name in English, you can say the place inside where I put my car. Or you can say, it's next to my house, I keep things there.
He says you can also use shorter phrases, such as, it's similar to, or it's the opposite of. Hinshaw says doing this can help learners of any language. As a Spanish learner, he does it himself. The next exercise is thinking in simple sentences. For example, if you are sitting in a park, you can tell yourself things like, it's such a beautiful day, and people are playing sports with their friends. Once this becomes easy, you can move on to more difficult sentences. Hinshaw sometimes uses this exercise to think about what he wants to say to people in Spanish.
I definitely try to say these sentences in my head or try to put the words together without thinking too much about if it's absolutely correct.
Another exercise experts suggest is to describe your daily activities. There are a few ways to do this. Thomas asks his beginning-level students to describe their day using the simple present verb form. So they would think to themselves things like, I put on my shirt, and he drives the bus. Other experts say you can mentally make plans in the morning when you wake up. This would require other verb tenses, so the skill level is a little higher. For example, you might tell yourself, when I leave the house, I'm going to get an iced coffee. Then I'll take the train to class. I'm studying with Paula today. She said she booked a study room at the library for 2 p.m. Now let's move to thinking in conversation. When you do this, you are imagining yourself speaking to someone else. You are asking the questions and thinking of replies. This is a great way to practice what you might say in a real conversation. For example, let's say the imaginary person asks you a question like, "What did you think of the award show last night?" How would you answer? Imagine the conversation and practice it in your head. You can do this out loud or in silence. For all of these exercises, there will, of course, be words and phrases that you do not know. So, at some point, you will need to use a dictionary. If your skill level is high enough, you might consider using an English to English dictionary. Hinshaw suggests writing down just 5 to 10 new words and phrases each day. Keeping a notebook, he says, helps you remember the situation that you needed that word or phrase for. This makes it easy to recall when you are in such a situation again. So, how much time should you spend on these exercises? Thomas says, do a little every day.
So when you're doing it every day, over and over again, little by little, that's the key. Because when you make things a habit, then it just pops up into your mind without thinking. And then before you know it, really, you're thinking in English.
I'm Alice Bryant.
Today on The Making of a Nation, we look at the history of early American Indians. Here is Steve Ember.
The native peoples of North and South America came from Siberia thousands of years ago. There was a land bridge between Siberia and Alaska before the end of the last ice age. As the group settled different parts of the land, they developed their own cultures and religions. Each group's story is important in the history of the Americas. But our story today will focus on the tribes in what became the central part of the United States. In 1804, Meriwether Lewis and William Clark led a group of explorers to the Pacific Ocean. They met the tribes of the Great Plains. The explorers were perhaps the first white people these Native Americans had ever seen. When the group of explorers neared the eastern side of the Rocky Mountains, they encountered the Shoshone tribe. Meriwether Lewis was the first to see them. Imagine for a moment that we are with Meriwether Lewis near the Rocky Mountains. Across a small hill, a group of 60 Shoshone men are riding toward us. The first thing we see is that these men are ready for war. Each is armed with a bow and arrow. Some carry long poles with a sharp knife at the end. They are riding very fast. Some of the horses look like they do not have riders. But as they get closer, we see that the riders are hanging off the sides of the horses or under the neck. They are using the horses' bodies for protection. The horses are painted with many different designs in blue, black, red, and other colors. Later, we learn that each design has a special meaning for the man who owns the horse. Each one tells a story. For example, the rider of one of the horses is a leader in battle. Another has killed an enemy. As they come nearer, the Shoshone group sees that we are not ready for war. They slow their horses, but are still very careful. Meriwether Lewis holds up an open hand as a sign of peace. The leader of the Shoshone does the same. They come closer. The Shoshone are dressed in clothes made from animal skins. Most of these skins are from deer or buffalo. The skins also have designs and tell stories like the designs on the horses. One design shows that someone has fought in a battle. Another shows that the person has been in many raids to capture horses. Still another shows that someone saved the life of a friend. Meriwether Lewis smiles at these men. He and the Shoshone chief cannot speak each other's language. The explorer again makes a sign of peace, and the sign is again returned. One young Shoshone comes near.
He gets off his horse. He is tall and looks strong. His hair is long and black. He wears one long bird feather in the back of his hair. His arms have been painted with long lines. We learn that each line represents a battle. There are many lines on his arms. Fortunately, we are able to continue our travels without a need for him to add another line. Many tribes, including the Shoshone, populated the area known as the Great Plains. The land they lived on influenced the lives and cultures of these Indian nations. The plains stretch across the central part of the country and north into Canada and south to Mexico. Even in a car traveling at 100 kilometers an hour, it can take 2 long days of driving to cross the Great Plains. In the east, the plains begin near the Mississippi River and go west to the huge Rocky Mountains. There are big rivers here and deserts. Some areas are so flat that a person can see for hundreds of kilometers. Huge areas of this land were once covered by thick grasses. Those grasses provided food for an animal that made possible the culture of the Indians of the Great Plains. The grass fed the buffalo or bison that were the center of native culture in the Great Plains. The huge animals provided meat for the Indians and much more. They were an important part of the religion of most of the native people of the Great Plains. The Lakota tribe, sometimes called the Sioux, believed that everything necessary for life could be found in the buffalo. The back of the animal provided the thick skins that the Plains Indians used to make their homes. Other parts of the buffalo hide were made into clothing and warm blankets. The bones were made into tools. No part of the animal was wasted. No one knows how many buffalo were in North America when Meriwether Lewis first met the Shoshone, but experts believe there were probably between 60 million and 75 million. Another animal also played an important part in the Indian cultures of the Great Plains. When Native Americans first saw these animals, they called them big dogs or mystery dogs. They had no word for this kind of animal in their languages. We know it as the horse. The horse had long been extinct in North America.
You have to understand that there were horse species here, you know, millions of years ago, but they died out 10,000 years ago, and so no one had seen a horse.
Until the arrival of Christopher Columbus and other Spanish explorers. Emil Hermeni Horses, curator at the Smithsonian National Museum of the American Indian in Washington, describes the at first frightening sight to the Native Americans.
So what comes back with the Spaniards, with Christopher Columbus on his second voyage, are horses as we know them today, the large animals. And so you can understand that people who had never seen these before, then to see a rider on top of it, dressed in armor, it must have looked like this tank coming at you that you did not know what it was. So, of course, it struck fear. The Spaniards, the conquistadors capitalized on that, realizing that it was causing fear and confusion, that they actually put bells on here. So even adding that extra level of noise to frighten the natives who never encountered the horse.
Before the introduction of horses to North America, Indians mostly traveled by foot. Traveling long distances was difficult. So was hunting buffalo. The horse greatly changed life for the tribes of the Great Plains. It gave them a new way to travel and to carry food and equipment. It made it easier and safer for them to follow and hunt the buffalo.
Originally, you may have killed one or two buffalo, where if you're on horseback, you'd be able to kill more buffalo.
The Smithsonian's Emil Hermeni Horses, who is a member of the Oglala Lakota.
And with killing more buffalo, you had more meat, you had more resources to make clothing from the hides, and also to make teepees. So things became more and bigger. So you might see a bigger teepee because you had more hides, you were able to kill more buffalo and process it, and so more abundance.
The horse made it possible to attack an enemy far away and return safely. The measure of a tribe's wealth became the number of horses it owned. Spanish settlers rode horses to the small town of Santa Fe in what is now the southwestern state of New Mexico. They arrived there in about 1609. How Native Americans got their first horses is not known. Perhaps they traded for them, perhaps they captured them. Soon, many tribes were doing both. By the 1750s, all the tribes of the Great Plains had horses. They had become experts at raising, training, and riding them. And they became experts at horse medicine. Indians of the Great Plains could ride a horse by the age of 5. As an adult, a man would have one horse for work. Another would be specially trained for hunting.
A horse would be trained to ride into the herd. You know, and buffaloes are noted as being, although they're huge and their size, but they can turn very quickly. So a horse had to be ready and be able to anticipate that. So you did have hunting horses that were trained to ride into a herd of buffalo.
And a third would be trained for war. An Indian warrior's success depended on how closely he and his horse worked together.
You wanted to train this horse. I mean, you were one in battle with the horse. When you went into battle, you were a brother, an ally, a comrade. So the horse was trained to fight in close skirmishes.
George Catlin was an artist who traveled in the early American West. He painted many pictures of the Indians and their horses. Catlin said the Plains Indian was the greatest rider the world had ever known. He said the moment an Indian laid a hand on his horse, he became part of the animal. Both the buffalo and the horse were extremely important to the Plains Indians. Because the horse made hunting easier, more time could be spent on other activities, including art. The Plains Indians began to make designs on their clothing and on blankets for their horses. The arrival of white settlers on the Great Plains marked the beginning of the end for the horse and buffalo culture of the Indians. Settlers did not want buffalo destroying their crops. Great numbers of buffalo were killed. By 1885, the Indians of the Great Plains were mostly restricted to areas called reservations.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.